Queer and ally fam, listen up. Whether you're searching for a queer-owned coffee shop, a queer-owned tattoo studio, or the coziest queer-owned bookshop, Everywhere is Queer has your back. Our free app connects you to over 17,300 queer-owned businesses worldwide. We have 26 different categories for you to filter between, and yes, we have an online queer-owned business section in app. Our app is available globally on iOS and Android because safer spaces should be everywhere. And if you own a queer business, you'll apply for free via the profile tab of our app. It is now more than ever, the queer, trans, and ally community knows where our safer spaces are, all while supporting queer entrepreneurs. Download Everywhere is Queer today and let's build community together.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
This episode and the entire year of episodes is proudly brought to you by California Cryobank. Use code LOVEISLOVE for a free level 2 subscription to their donor catalog at cryobank.com.
The Queer Family Podcast. Love is love on the Queer Family Podcast. Love is love on the Queer Family Podcast. Love is love on the Queer Family Podcast. Love is love.
I had read an article, and I do not remember when or where I read this, but I had read an article about two women who got pregnant at the same time. Mm-hmm. And it was in my head as just, you know, and of course the article's talking about all the reasons it was hard and complicated and, you know, and blah, blah, blah. But it was like, I was like, that's cool.
Welcome y'all to the Queer Family Podcast, the show all about family, but with gay. I'm your gay host, Jamie. And this is the show that, as you know, highlights, celebrates, uplifts, and normalizes LGBTQIA families in all of our fabulously, gorgeously beautiful identities. Oof. And this episode is a fun one, y'all, because it is like, it's so lesbian. It is like the ultimate lesbian story. I'm not going to say much, but we got some reciprocal IVF, and we got two ladies pregnant at the same time. That's it. That's all you got to know. It's, yep. We also dive into a lot of donor conception and what that means for our kids and all the things and second parent adoption, all the things that go in our queer families and the beauty of them. And it got me thinking about a time way back in like season one. I interviewed this woman named Emma, and she was the daughter of gay moms and had been conceived in the 80s with donor sperm, back when it was like really, truly always anonymous and they had no idea who this person was. And she was telling a story about how when she was asking about the donor one day, one of her moms had her just draw a picture of what she thought the donor looked like because they didn't have any pictures. And of course, a little bit later, I'm at home after I had interviewed Emma, and my daughter, who was 4 at the time, started asking about the donor. And she wanted to know what the donor looked like as an adult because we have baby pictures of him, but we don't have adult pictures. And I thought of Emma's story. I said, oh, well, why don't we draw a picture of what you think he looks like? And so she did. She drew this picture, and we have had this picture ever since she drew it when she was 4. She's 11 now. It's been on our fridge ever since. And this is it. If you're watching the video, you get to see. She even named him. I don't remember what she named him, but it's very fitting. I actually think it looks a lot like him. She drew a nice rainbow shirt on him, which I think is fitting. Obviously, he's going to wear rainbow shirts. We chose him. And I think it actually really does look like him because I actually really do know what he looks like now. But anyway, so we've had this up forever. And my son, who's 7, he has shown a lot less interest in knowing the donor. You know, each kid is different and you have to let them lead the way. We have the folder with the pictures in it, and we bring it out whenever either child asks questions. And, you know, he was asking about the donor, and he wanted to know what the donor looked like as an adult. So I said, well, we have the picture on the fridge. Did you know that Rose drew this? And this is what she thought he looked like. And he was like, that doesn't look anything like me. That's not him. That's not the donor. It's so funny how the kids are so different. And then I said, well, do you want to see some baby pictures of him again? Because we have them. He said, yeah, I do. He looked at them for like 2 seconds and then he was done. And then he was like asking me about my favorite Pokemon and we had moved on. But always good to have all these things. That's why this podcast is so important, because it's so great to hear what other people do to help their kids understand they're beautifully queer and all the things, families. Anyway, I want to roll this tape because this is sort of a longer episode. So I'm going to get to the episode. I love y'all. Hope y'all are staying safe and taking care of your mental health right now in these trying times. I'm here for you. I love you. I have my woke and proud t-shirt on to hold on to my wokeness. And I hope y'all are holding on to your wokeness too. You can get this shirt in my shop, by the way, in the show notes, if you're interested in getting some woke paraphernalia. I don't know if paraphernalia is the right word, but you catch my drift. All right, Helen, Beulah, Gerson, please roll that tape. Let's go. Two moms pregnant at the same time.
Queer Family Podcast, love is love.
Hi, Anna and Becky.
Hi, Jamie.
Hi.
It is such a pleasure to be here with you in the virtual studio. Let's just dive right in. Let's dive into your 30-second elevator pitch, because I want the guests to know who you are and why you're here talking to the Queer Fam Squad. I'm very excited for this because this is a doozy, this story. That's all I'm going to say. I'm going to let you take it away. All right, here we go. On your marks, get set, go.
I'm Anna.
And I'm Becky.
We live in the San Francisco Bay Area. We got married in our living room in summer of 2020 and then decided that we wanted to have exactly two children. So we started building our family through simultaneous reciprocal IVF. Our two boys were born 2 years ago, 5.5 weeks apart. And we're here to talk about why and how and the pros and cons and what we learned along the way.
Boom. You did that in 24 seconds. You get an award for that. And also, reciprocal IVF at the exact same time. What the hell?
What were we thinking? Yeah, we got that. We still get that a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm so excited to dive in. But before we dive in, let's get to know you a little bit. So like, how did the two of you meet? What's your backstory? Give us a little rundown of that.
We technically met on OkCupid.
As you do.
But it turns out we realized when we were texting each other that we had a mutual friend.
A very close mutual friend
who had been trying to either introduce us or set us up for months.
Incredibly ineffectually.
Clearly, yeah. But this is so lesbian, though. This is like, I knew it was going to turn into very lesbian-y
here. As a result, we took a selfie on our first date so that we could
send to our friends.
So now we have
a first date selfie, which is great, because we would never have done that
otherwise. That'd be kind of creepy.
Yeah, totally. Ooh, can we take a selfie? Is it framed and like up on a wall somewhere?
It should be, because it's a pretty great selfie. It should be, but no, it is not. That's a good idea.
Oh my God, it totally should be.
We'll do that, yeah.
I don't know why I'm thinking of this for you. I never think these things. You should get somebody to paint it.
Ooh,
well, that's funny because we actually have a painting from that friend's wife of our kids based on a photo of our kids. So that could actually happen.
Oh my God, that's so full circle if you do that with that picture.
Totally. Okay.
So right. Lesbian.
We'll make this happen.
So you met and did we have a U-Haul situation?
Pretty much. We had three dates over 2 weeks and then immediately stopped counting because it was just...
Right, like every night.
Every night. So, yeah. You know.
You moved in, basically.
Right. Not moved in, but we officially moved in like
six months later.
That tracks.
It's the Bay Area, so it's, you know,
it's a big commitment. It's a big commitment to
give up rent control, for example.
Oh, yeah. It's expensive. I feel you. I moved from a very expensive city to another very expensive city. So I'm not winning on any counts here at all. When did talk of baby making come into the picture? Because for us queers, usually has to happen pretty early on because we got to get on the same page.
I didn't come out until my mid-late 30s. As part of that, decided... I can't remember the exact timing of when I decided this, but I was like, you know what? I'm heading for my late 30s. I'm single. You know what? It's not happening for me. No kids.
Oh.
And I had really, really, really wanted kids when I was younger, probably not for the right reasons, you know?
And so, do any of us really want them for the right reasons?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. So I decided, I was like, you know, in my head, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to come to peace with the fact that I'm not having kids and I'm going to just go all in on that. And so my mindset was that, you know, I wasn't going to have kids. And then...
Well, right. And I think we first talked about it. I mean, I think I brought it up sort of a little bit, but kind of very theoretical. Maybe, I don't remember the number, you know, if the fifth date or, you know, within the first like 3 or 4 weeks. Yeah. And I think at that point, yeah, you sort of said, I mean, you didn't say like, no, definitely not. But
yeah. And then I had also had something in my dating profile that I had not removed, which was, I just came out. I'm not looking for anything serious. So this is, you know, just, this is just for fun. And finally we're like, he's like, you know what? This is getting pretty serious. We need to check in about what this
is. Right. This feels like this is serious, but you know.
So I think we had a couple of conversations and then, you know, then we're, you know, I was,
right. I think I followed up, convinced. I followed up not too much later yeah. because I, you know, I wasn't certain that I wanted to have kids. I feel like I always felt like I probably wanted to have kids, but I was never like, yes, I definitely want to have kids. But I definitely, in getting into a serious relationship, wanted to make sure that the other person was open mm-hmm. to have, you know, right. was also yeah. sort of in a similar, like, probably or potentially, yeah. you know, not like a hard pass. Yeah. So I definitely think some other time within the next 6 months, we had a yeah. few more conversations yeah. that kind of made clear that, like, okay.
And then, of course, then I was very excited.
This is what happens in all, like, so many of our relationships, because if you're not queer, if you're one of the non-queers, as I call them, these aren't really questions you ever really ask yourself, or you don't need to ask your partner all the time. So a lot of times I'll talk, like, I had a friend who ended up getting divorced because they had never talked about it. And then they were getting older and then she was like, wait, it's time. We have to do this. And he was like, I don't want kids. I'm not having kids. And he wouldn't budge. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think that yeah. there are some instances, like, especially in the non-queer world, where they don't necessarily talk about it, because it's kind of just assumed, just like all the roles that you play in the house mm-hmm. are assumed and all the things like that. But with us, the sky's the limit. It could be anything. So we have to talk about this stuff, right? Like, there are no assumed roles.
I think they probably should be. They should be talking about it.
Yes, that's
well,
my point.
At least some of them are. I mean, I do know that at least some of them,
of course. And this is not across the board. And I am not an expert in any way, shape, or form. This is just my way of saying queers are better.
That's it.
That's all I mean to say with that, because it's true. It's so true. But also, I've been realizing I'm saying lesbian. It's such a lesbian story. I don't even know how the two of you identify.
We both do identify as lesbian, yeah.
Okay, good. Woo. Okay. let the lesbian jokes fly. So, Becky, you convinced Anna. And then what?
Yeah. Well, and then we wanted to do the whole getting married thing.
To keep it traditional.
Also keep it buttoned up legal, and also just, get to know each other better.
Right,
and all
right.
That.
I mean, I feel like the more important part was just that, you know. Didn't want to start having kids with someone 6 months,
Becky.
6 months in. Yeah, that was really the main driver.
And then we were planning our wedding for the summer of 2020. And then our good friend COVID stepped in.
Yep.
And,
yep. Yeah. So. We were going to have, you know, like a bigger, not big, but, you know, maybe like a 100-person wedding. It turned into us by ourselves in our apartment.
In our living room.
It was actually really nice.
We had our the woman who was going to do our in-person, she did our online ceremony. Mm-hmm. And we had her in one laptop.
We had three laptops.
And our witnesses in the other two laptops.
Which was my brother and her sister.
And then a camera filming. It was a whole production. It was a lot of fun. We actually decided after we like had a whole weekend of like wedding events in our living room. And at the end of that, we were like, you know what? This was lovely. We don't need to do an in-person one after all this.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Interesting. It can work. It worked.
It can work. Yeah. It was just really sweet.
It was really nice to just turn off the cameras and just chill.
And be home. That was lovely.
Yeah. The party's, it's a lot. It takes a lot out of you.
And we wore silk pajamas for the wedding.
I don't know why I want to say that's so lesbian, but I'm just going to say it.
White and black silk pajamas. It was very lesbian. Yeah.
This is just a very lesbian story. Okay. Awesome. So you get married. Everything is hunky dory. And then you decide you want to go screw it all up by getting pregnant at the
same
time.
Exactly. Yeah. So,
well, we didn't go in saying, oh, at least at the beginning saying, okay, we're going to do it. It's going to be at the exact same time.
Walk us through your process.
So I was 38 when we met and 40 when we got married. And so obviously, you know, wanted to get started on things. And I had read an article, and I do not remember when or where I read this, but I had read an article about two women who got pregnant at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in my head as just, you know, and of course the article's talking about all the reasons it was hard and complicated and, and blah, blah, blah. But it was like, I was like, that's cool. That's a thing that exists. And we started talking about kids. And, you know, we knew that primarily because of my age, we wanted to, you know, get our family started.
Well, started and finished.
Started and finished. Right. Started and finished. We had settled pretty quickly, I think, on reciprocal IVF because mm-hmm. we both wanted to have a genetically related child. Mm-hmm. And I think I wanted to carry. I don't think we were both super attached to caring, but because we wanted to, and we each wanted a genetic connection, that made sense. And then
and I think I did. I mean, I think a priori, I probably wasn't obsessed with caring, but at the same time, I think I did like with reciprocal that you sort of have the, you know, you have a genetic connection and you have the sort of birth connection.
But at this point, you were only thinking about one of you getting pregnant at this point, or were you already thinking we would do this at the same time?
I think it was in the mix pretty early as an option. Mm-hmm. And also because of my age, we decided to sort of go right to IVF as well. Because
uh-huh. Well, and given that we were thinking about reciprocal IVF,
that was another vote for reciprocal IVF you know, we might need to do IVF anyway. Let's just go right there.
If you're spending the money. Although, does it make it any more expensive? A little bit.
The reciprocal part? I don't think so.
I think it's pretty separate.
Because either way, you're going through the same steps, just switching the body between.
Right. You're going through two retrievals. You're going, or however many retrievals and however many transfers. So I don't think it matters who it goes into. That was what was in our mix. And then I think we had gone sort of back and forth on the exact timing and stuff. But then one thing was, you know, hey, it might take us several tries
tries.
You know, yeah. Right. It might take months and months and months. So even if we start trying at the same time, that is obviously no guarantee.
Right. We could still be,
many months apart or years apart or whatever, as these things go.
But neither one of you had an aversion to carrying. Sometimes in relationships, one of us has an aversion to carrying.
No, I mean, now we do.
I'm done. Me too.
One was enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our motto is two and through. Yeah. So yeah.
Was the ultimate goal, like the big wish that you that it happens at the same time? Was that the wish?
We wanted kids to be close together. You know, part of our thinking too was like, how do we help our kids feel as connected to each other as possible? Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, their siblings growing up in the same house, obviously they're going to, you know, feel close.
You would hope.
And, you know, so we went with the same sperm donor for both of them. And, mm-hmm. you know, we went with reciprocal IVF so that we would each have, you know, a different connection to each of them. And then, yeah, I think having them close together in age as well, as close as possible, was something that we thought about in terms of their closeness to each other. And also, I sort of had this thing in my head about the grandparents. And this is something, and this was a thing that from talking to other families where it's like, well, it's, you know, it's really hard for the grandparents not to show a little more interest in the grandkid that looks like them, you know, that's a hard thing not to do. And so part of my mind was, well, if they come at the same time, that'll be really hard for them to do even subconsciously. And I have to say all the grandparents have been,
first of all, I don't think it would have been a problem.
No. And all the grandparents have been totally amazing with both kids and like really into both kids. So that's never been an issue.
But that is a valid fear that deserves a little bit of airtime, because I had that fear because my wife carried one and I carried mm-hmm. the other years apart. But, and I went second and I was afraid that my in-laws wouldn't take as fondly to the one I gave birth to. It was a fear I had. I squashed it quickly and I didn't speak on it because it's such a taboo thing to speak on, right? But it is a fear. And I think that it's something that I think it merits being brought up, because I think a lot of us have these thoughts in our heads and we are afraid to speak them out loud.
Yeah, no, it was definitely just because I had spoken to someone and you know, their experience was that, like, you know, they can't help being just a little tiny bit more interested in that baby that, you know, especially when also, you know, with the reciprocal IVF, it's also a little different because, you know, it's like my mom is really interested in my experience of giving birth. And so that's, you know, and that's not the baby she's related to. So that was also part of that.
It really is the ultimate lesbian goal. Let's be real here. Like, it's the best. If we could have done that, we would have. We were just not in a space to do it. But like, it's going to give you the closest tie, both of you, to this child, because one of us can't be genetically related. That's just the shit way that it is, you know? It's very few families in the queer community that each get to have a biological tie.
Well, I'd like to say that we're epigenetically related.
You are.
Yeah.
And epigenetics is a really strong thing. when it comes to what gets turned on in the womb because of the carrier.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's pretty amazing. It's pretty awesome. I love it. Okay, so the ultimate goal was reciprocal IVF and as close to each other as possible. Let's dive into your donor, though, because we haven't really delved into that. What kind of a donor did you get, and what were your thoughts surrounding the donor?
We ended up getting an anonymous donor, which I think was our first preference. I think both of us were sort of hesitant around some of the complexity that can come in with a known donor.
Same.
Obviously, that can work very well for some people. I had a friend who had an experience of being a known donor, and his mom was like, yay, I have grandchildren. And they were like, no, you don't. And so that was a whole, you know, so it's like that was a level of complexity that obviously doesn't always happen. And but sometimes does.
Yeah. Sometimes does. Yeah.
And we did look into known donor a little bit, mainly in the sort of like friend of friend category. So like people that we sort of, you know, weren't on a day-to-day basis with.
We were, we were very much impacted. Our timeline was very much impacted by the great pandemic sperm shortage, which is a thing that I don't think gets enough airtime.
Let's talk about that a little, because I'm not sure I know too much about that. I wasn't looking for sperm at that time.
Mm-hmm. It was really hard to get sperm during the pandemic, along with toilet paper. You know, it was hard to get sperm.
Well, that would make sense, I guess, because...
Right, because the clinics, right, closed for a while. And then, for example, like a lot of donors might be college students who now aren't at, you know, are at home. They're not near, you know, near where they might have been for a clinic.
They're in their mom's basement, not in their dorm. It's a lot harder to donate sperm in that situation.
And, you know, mom's paying their phone bills or whatever bills. So they don't need the extra cash. Like, I know.
Totally. And then once stuff did come online, of course, we have the six-month quarantine business. So we sort of were looking around at this, you know, we started looking in sort of early 2021 for this. We're having a hard time finding anything. And so we sort of at that point, we're like, well, okay, let's look into known donors. And we made some inquiries there. One of the things that I was both happy and sad to learn is that we were looking at sort of male acquaintances who we liked and respected and who had children already and their family building was done. And they have all had vasectomies. They've all had vasectomies. And not only have they had vasectomies, they didn't bother to freeze 10 vials of sperm before they had the vasectomy, which why not freeze 10? Like if you're going to have a vasectomy, just first of all, good for you. And just freeze some sperm beforehand in case your lesbian friends come asking.
It's for the lesbians, not for you.
For the lesbians. or for, you know.
When we all start this baby making journey, we're just so excited to do it. We make our decisions. I know for me, I didn't think that much about even the implications of using an anonymous donor ID donor. But now I have children and I'm realizing, oh wow, that's a thing and that's a thing. And maybe I should have thought that through more, right? This is why conversations like this need to happen for all those folks who are about ready to start. We'll be right back.
Podcast, love is love.
Okay, this sounds like a really great time to interrupt this episode just to tell you about my promo code at California Cryo Bank, because you might be getting ready to start that family. And if you're looking for using donor sperm at a cryobank, California Cryo Bank is the one for you. You're just going to go to cryobank.com. You're going to use code love is love, and it's going to get you a free level 2 subscription to their donor catalog. They have been helping Le Jeptiquois folks make their families for over 45 years. They are trusted in the industry. I use them to make my babies, and I don't regret it one bit. I absolutely love the family I made with the help of California Cryobank, and I think you will too. They have a very large and diverse selection of donors available on their site, and they give all kinds of benefits to the Le Jeptiquois community, like second parent adoption letters if you need them, and much, much more. So if you're looking to start that family, head to cryobank.com right now. Use code love is love, and maybe, just maybe, you will find your donor. Okay, let's get back to the episode.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance, like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Love is love.
when we started looking, there was not a comprehensive genetic screen on a lot of the donors. And they got tested for sort of like the most common, like Tay-Sachs and like the sort of high profile ones. They didn't have blanket genetic, like a lot of them didn't have that. That came in as we were partly
Those screens existed.
Those screens existed, but they weren't like routinely, everyone didn't have them. Like you didn't look at the donor and didn't get like your download of the 300 things. But that kind of came in halfway through our process. I think after we had already done our first, first embryos at that point. But like, so yeah, that was just coming in. And the one thing that I think is going to be interesting to watch in that space is now there are screens for cancer genes and heart disease genes. And that's a whole new, that's a whole different.
Oh, that's new. Yeah.
And that's a thing that we became aware of last year. But, that's a whole other thing that isn't on the radar yet. But, you know, and again, it's another thing that's like, you know, gosh, it's already so hard to find sperm donors who are eligible with all the requirements. And like,
I know. Yeah. And it's just going to make it harder, but it's all for the best. And I hope that most cryobanks, most sperm banks, or all of them, I would hope, are doing their due diligence to get to the more ethical area of sperm donation. I hate using the word ethical, but
as you say, this is like what we have to do to make our families.
Yeah, and exactly.
It's obviously unethical not to have that option for us. And so it's sort of just trying to make it as good a process it can be under the circumstances. And it's, you know, like this is human procreation. It is never going to be perfect. It's never going to be risk-free. And that's not the point of it. It's more just sort of having whatever information feels important and relevant to you and your family to make those decisions.
To keep it as safe as possible and to keep the child in mind the most, you know, that's really the end goal. Because that's the donor-conceived community. That's what they get up in arms about is that they were hurt. They were hurt because of the problems in donor conception.
And I'm guessing that most clinics do this now, but the sperm bank that we used requires that the donor is willing to meet their...
When they turn 18. Yeah. And nowadays, I think they don't do fully anonymous donation anymore. I don't think you can.
Yeah.
That has become a thing. Open ID. That's what I was trying to think of earlier. Ooh. Open ID. We have an open ID donor. But when we were shopping for sperm, you could still get completely anonymous. We went with the open ID. All awesome stuff. Amazing.
The one thing that was really funny for us, funny, but like the big roadblock we faced then was actually getting sperm.
Right.
Because so we finally like found a donor who we recognized, you know, like, okay, this is our donor. And then the way that they work is they ration the sperm because they have donors, you know, a new donor comes on and everyone's like, oh, that one, that's our, you know, very popular donor. And so you get 2 vials per release and a release is every few months because they're waiting for the next batch to clear quarantine. And
right.
2 vials per family.
Per family. 2 vials per family. We are one family.
But you're each like...
wanting to get pregnant, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's not going to go very far. And with IVF, I don't know, when I went through IVF, our doctor used 2 vials per cycle.
Oh, no, it was 1 vial per round. We were pretty confident that there was going to be the need between the two of us to have more than one round.
So this was like the most stressful part of our process.
Well, right. Yeah. And the problem there too, in terms of the number of rounds, is that before either of us got pregnant, we needed to have all of the embryos that we were going to possibly have
ever,
right? Because basically...
Once either of us got pregnant, basically we were done for life because, you know, by the time, at least, especially for me, you know, with my age, like by the time I finished being pregnant and however much time had gone by, I would be in my...
Oh, you can't harvest new eggs.
I can't harvest new eggs. Right. Yeah.
So you need to get them all.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, gotcha. And then... Right. And for Becky, less so, but we also, wanted it to be done. So we had this very, very stressful experience. So it's limited to 2 vials and you have to phone them the morning of the release be early enough in line to actually get the 2 vials because they run out.
Oh my God, that's very stressful.
And I think they only have the possibility of putting like 3 people on hold at one time. Oh, so you basically keep calling and keep hitting a busy signal.
It's like calling the radio show.
Yeah, no, like literally.
Back in the day. Back in the day.
Like we had them on speed dial and we were both just like.
It was the most stressful 5 minutes. Yeah. And then you get, you know, then they're like, "Spermic Alfred, can you hold?" And we're like, "Yes, we can hold." I think this is, and then you're like,
"Oh, yeah, God." Yeah.
The second time we did it, which was even more stressful than the first, right? Because the first, it's like, if we don't get it, maybe we pivot, maybe we even use another donor. The second time we did it, we had already done one round. And so we really wanted to use that same donor again. So we really needed to get, you know, that sperm.
And when you say one round, you say one of you already
did a retrieval and
so did a
retrieval. With fertilization.
So we got two. So the first time we did this, we got two vials. Mm-hmm. And as soon as we got those vials, we were all set up with our clinic. We started our egg retrievals. And so we did them they were very close, basically at the same time, our egg retrievals. And so Becky went first. And so that was one vial each. And so Becky went first. You had, I think, 11 eggs.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. 11 eggs.
Seven fertilized.
Yeah. And then seven. Yeah. And then all seven made it.
All seven made it to blastocyst. It was, they were just like, I know.
I mean, congratulations.
I know.
Yeah.
That's how I felt, too.
Those are good numbers.
So we're like,
And they were, you know, had reasonable quality and, you know, and I'm a bit, you know, a bit younger than Anna as well. So we're like, okay, like we looked at the statistics. So we're like, okay, it seems like, you know, in the upper 90% that like pregnancy would be possible with these embryos.
That's awesome.
I got two sad BC grade.
Sorry.
It was like.
Oh, that's the worst. Well, so that happened to me too.
So we were like, okay, we need more sperm. Right. And we got to now wait the 3 months for the next batch of sperm. Right. And we got to do the phone call thing again. And we get through.
No, but the thing we did too is that we
here's how we cheated.
Our dirty trick. We had another friend come over. So it was three of us.
Smart.
And then our friend got through.
She was actually the one that got through and handed it to us. Yeah.
It takes a village. It takes a village.
And like come over and sit on our porch 6 feet away from us because we're still in COVID.
Right.
And speed dial our sperm bank, please. Thank you. You're a great friend.
Talk about a true lesbian story right there. There it is. Oh my God. So amazing. So you got him again.
Oh, and we took selfies with I went because this was all local to us. Each time I drove to the sperm bank, got the big nitrogen tank with the vials inside, and I drove home.
Right, I was doing work from home.
Becky was working from home. Drove home. We posed.
Took a selfie.
Took a selfie with our sperm.
And then drove it
to the clinic and dropped it off.
Oh, my God.
And the fun part is that we have two of those photos from the two batches, and one of our kiddos was born from the first batch, and one of our kiddos was born from the second batch. So they each have their own sperm selfie photo. And we almost didn't do the second one. And Becky's like, "No, just drive, you know, come
just
on.
In case.
Like, we
just
need to
in
do
case.
This. We need to do this."
Oh, that's so sweet. And you had to put them in their little origin story books.
We did origin story books, and
you
they
did.
Are in there. Yes.
Yeah.
We have board books. We made board books for them of
so
their
sweet.
Origin stories with
right.
all that.
Complete with the selfie and also a picture of them as an embryo.
Yeah. The embryo photo is the coolest thing.
I feel like it's like IVF worth it just for that.
Just for that. Like, this was you as a
so
cell.
Cool, though.
So then I did two more rounds. Mm-hmm. And my second round was the winner. And I got three high quality eggs from that one.
Okay.
We did one more insurance round and I got three more moderate eggs.
Was this all covered by insurance?
So we had a
right,
little.
So I work in tech. And so they do have some coverage for IVF.
Fertility benefits.
For fertility benefits.
That's good. That's better than most.
Yeah. No, it is. And it helps substantially.
So we had this coverage, and when we were talking to our clinic, they said, "Well, you know, we have cash prices and we have insurance prices."
What?
So, we sort of had to decide in advance because we had, you know, sort of limited.
Right, and if
coverage.
You use the insurance price, my understanding is if your insurance doesn't cover all of it, you cover the rest,
right.
which then could end up being worse for us in theory than us just having paid the cash price. But
such
you don't have
bullshit.
Solid
and
numbers
they, yeah.
to begin with.
Yeah. They,
so
yeah.
you're just kind of
such
guessing
bullshit.
As to where you're going to end up in
so
terms
we,
of what amount of money you
ended
have.
Up slightly underutilizing the insurance.
Yeah, but
I mean,
it
anyway,
was still very helpful.
It was very helpful
yeah.
to have it.
Helpful. But also, what the actual fuck? That is so ridiculous. That makes me angry.
I think that's a pretty common feature of medical stuff.
And it's, you know, it's great that they are offering cash prices to help people, but it just made them, it made the mental load just so much of like, oh, okay, should we do these meds for cash? Should we try to put them through the insurance? And of course it's going to take months for all the
You don't find out, you don't find out what's gotten covered and what hasn't and all that until like months and months later.
Calls. Yeah. So yeah, it's, they need an overhaul anyway. Yeah. So
we finally have all of our embryos. Yeah, we used all of our four vials of sperm. We've got our embryos. We're ready to go. And so now we're like, okay, now this is sort of the final decision of, yes, we're going to do this at the same time.
Or at least, right, at least start out that way.
And then our fertility clinic said, you cannot go at the same time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What? Why? Because why? What was their reasoning?
Their reasoning was because we were doing reciprocal IVF, we were sort of in two places in their system at the same time. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want us, they couldn't have one person
be involved in two transactions
two things at the same time. So,
interesting.
I went first, then I did a transfer. My first transfer was unsuccessful. My second transfer, I got pregnant and stayed pregnant. And then
amazing.
Basically, then I went in for the 6 and the 8 week scans with the fertility clinic. And then at 8 weeks, they said, okay, you're graduated. And now, now we do Becky. Right. Now we can do Becky.
Now it's your turn.
Now it's your turn.
Yeah.
And Becky, were you nervous at all? Like when she got pregnant and then like time is ticking by. Like, did you get nervous? I would, because I'm neurotic and I'm crazy. I would have gotten really nervous that it wasn't going to work for me.
Well, I mean, I think I was nervous that it wasn't going to work for me. But I guess I don't know that it was specifically about like the timing. I don't think that I was like so driven by like it needs to be kind of at the same time. I mean, definitely after getting pregnant, I, you know, spent months looking at those tables of like the, you know, percent chance of miscarriage by age and gestational week.
Oh, God. Yeah.
But yeah. So the next time, so this was also my second time of a transfer, and that also was successful.
Amazing.
So yeah, and they both you know took.
Yeah. So there we were, 7.5 weeks apart, pregnant.
Yeah. And they started about 7 weeks apart, and then you know were born more like five and a half weeks apart.
Oh yeah, because that's how it shakes out. But like, what were people's reactions when you told them we're both pregnant? Like,
I mean, we had sort of told people our plan, and that's when we usually got.
Are you sure?
Are you sure?
Yeah, a lot of that. A few people were like, that's very cool. That's so cool. And most people were like, do you have any idea what you're doing? Have you thought about this at all? Do you not know that, you know, this is a big deal?
Oh, God.
We got support. We definitely got support. We got a lot of, just want to make sure you thought this through. Yeah. Like, yes, we're lesbians. We have thought this through a lot. Right. That's all we've been doing for the last 3 years is thinking this through.
Right.
That's going to be my answer for everything. Yes, I'm a lesbian. Yes, I'm a lesbian. You're both pregnant. How'd it go? What was it like?
I mean, it went fine is the short answer. And I think for some reason, neither of us, I think, are too affected emotionally by hormones, generally speaking.
I don't know, but at least in terms of the pregnancy, it didn't seem like there were sort of any big mood swings or things like that, especially.
Neither of us got morning sickness.
Oh, you're
which
so
was
lucky.
Amazing. Yeah. What we did have was the extreme fatigue, and this was like the worst thing.
But we managed to swap off. We literally over a weekend, we swapped off.
So I was sort of tired. Sleepwalking for, I don't know, six weeks or something. And then I woke up one day and felt fine. And then the next day, Becky's like, I'm going to just sleep all day.
Yeah.
Oh my God. There's mercy in this universe.
Cuddling got harder. Yes. We had giant bumps in the way everywhere we turned. They were pregnancies. They were uncomfortable and you know, but we had
a lot of pillows in the bed to, you know, figure out like which style of pregnancy pillow we'd be using at what moment.
But no, I mean, honestly, our pregnancies went as well as they could have gone given our ages, and we didn't have any, pretty much nothing went seriously wrong. We had, you know, the usual sort of scans and things, and we did, so we decided not to test our embryos. Mm-hmm.
That was another very long decision.
That was another very long decision. We decided not to test our embryos. We felt that the risk of losing an embryo through that process was not worth it. At least 2-3 years ago when we were looking at this, I guess 3-4 years ago now we were looking at this, the testing is not 100%.
And which kind of testing are you talking? Are you talking about?
We're talking
PGT-A.
About the PGT. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To look for chromosomal abnormalities in the cells. Right. And so it didn't feel reliable enough to us, given that our issue was, you know, we have limited embryos.
Right, given the possible attrition.
And we worked really hard for those embryos. Yeah. And we didn't want to risk losing an embryo in order to get what might not be a fully accurate result. We did CVS testing at about 11 weeks of pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And thankfully, that all looked great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
we did the same, too.
Yeah. And then that's when we found out that even though we had both spent, independently, we had both spent weeks compiling lists of girl names.
Not because we specifically wanted girls, really. I don't think. It was more just like that somehow in our heads. We're like, oh, huh, yeah, we're probably having girls.
Probably having girls. We'll have girl names. My appointment is first. And, you know, it's a boy. And I'm like, okay, well, that's fine because it's, you know, it's Becky's genetic material. So obviously Becky is still pregnant with mini
with the
me,
girl.
With the girl.
Right. Oh, yeah. I feel you 100% right now. And the listeners know how hard it was for me to deal with the fact that I was having a boy. But like, it was a shock to me.
A shock to me. Yeah. And so then, of course, you know, 7 weeks later, Becky does her testing. And, you know, they leave it to the end of the call. They get all the other business out of the way first. And at the very end, they're like, okay, do you want to know the sex? And they actually said, it's male, which is, you know, usually they say boy or girl, but they said it's male. And I actually said, do you mean female? Those words came out of my mouth. And it really was surprise. And I think it took a week. Mm-hmm. Maybe to get over to kind of settle in. Yeah. And then, of course, immediately now we're like, we're having two boys.
Right. And what was great is that, like, when we were thinking about girl names, we both came up with really long lists that had no overlap.
Yeah.
And then we switched to boy names and we both had really short lists that had overlap.
Yeah. That's so, narrowed it down well.
Yeah. Yeah. Much easier process to agree on boy names.
Yeah.
So you narrow down the names and.
So then we're in the thick of planning for how the heck we're going to pull this off because, you know, we've got two babies coming very close together. And we had sort of had these conversations, obviously, before, you know, before we got pregnant when we were talking about all this. And we sort of, you know, there's a lot of risks in doing it this way. There is obviously always a lot that can go wrong with pregnancy. And we were setting ourselves up and with labor and with birth and all that. So, you know, we knew we were taking a pretty big risk in doing it this way because, you know, either of us could have had a cesarean, either of us could have had complications, either of the kids could have had, you know, complications or extra needs or anything. And so, and we have a little bit of family support locally, but, you know, neither of us grew up here, so we didn't have a huge network. And so we knew we needed birth doulas, obviously, because we were going to be either pregnant or newly postpartum at the other one's labor. And then we also made a plan to have postpartum doulas, and our sort of emergency option was just, okay, if we have to, we just bring in a lot of more postpartum doula help. That was basically our plan for that. Because
I'm sure if it came to it, we could have also called in more family support.
Yeah. If things went that badly wrong, we would have gotten on to relative, you know, families would have flown out and been with us and supported us and all that sort of thing.
But we knew that regardless of any complications, we really were going to need a postpartum doulas. And I think honestly that went a lot into the planning. And obviously, you know, we were sort of very privileged to be able to afford to do that. I really feel like to do this, you either need an extensive, you know, family or friend network that can support you, or, you know, a paid network to support you.
Yeah. I think we did some of that planning pretty well. And also, you know, we did not do nearly enough planning for postpartum. And I know you've had a lot of conversations about this on the show. I had deluded ideas about how much I would still be able to do around the house and all these things. And now I'm just like, why did I want that? Why did I not?
Because we're women and we think we're just used to doing everything.
And we're supposed to. And our identities tell us that, like, hey, your value and your worth as a woman, as a person, is based on your ability to do it all without complaining and without ever asking for help. And that is just such capitalist bullshit. So.
Yeah, it's so true. It's so true. And just to be fair, I didn't do anything thinking about the postpartum anything. Like, we didn't prepare for shit. Nothing. And it was both kids. It was a mess. It was a hot mess. I mean, you know, we all do that. So how'd the births go?
Same doula for both of us, which was really lovely. I went first. I ended up getting induced because of age. You know, so when you're over 35 and especially over 40, they don't want you to go over 40 weeks.
And you were already, and you were going.
Yeah, I got induced at 39 and a half weeks. For some reason, I decided I needed to do it without an epidural.
I had decided that too. That did not work out for me.
It barely worked out for me, but it did work out for me. I had an incredible male OB nurse with me.
Uh-huh.
And when he walked in the door, my doula took me aside and she said, look, it's the male nurse. Are you okay with that? And I said, absolutely. Thank you for checking. I am totally good with that. I had a deeply healing experience being in a lot of pain, making a lot of noise, and having a supportive man follow me around because he had to do the monitor. He had to keep the monitors on because I was on Pitocin because I got induced. And he just crawled around and followed me around. And he defended my birth. He had my birth plan memorized and he defended it to every single person who walked in the door. He was like, the doctor was like, oh, well, have you thought about it? And like, she doesn't want one. Before I even had a chance, before my doula had a chance. And I had this profoundly healing experience because I've been in straight relationships in the past. And for some reason, there is a set of cis straight men who really think that we're making up period cramps.
Oh, I know.
And I don't know what their obsession is with the fact that we're making up period cramps, but we are not making up period cramps. And so for some reason, having this man there who was taking care of me, he was doing an amazing job taking care of me, and he never once asked me to be quiet. He never once asked me to like do anything for his convenience. Like, oh, could you stay still? You know, like some nurses do. So I had a really amazing experience with that. And then I had a lot of pushing because one of the things you need to check when you're doing reciprocal IVF is what is the average head circumference of your spouse's family? So thanks, Becky. So I had the big headed baby.
Oh, dear. I never thought about that.
So, you know, and we should get that information from the donor, too. What was your head circumference at birth? Anyway, it went fine. It went great.
It was so critical to have that birth doula there, too.
Yes. No, the birth doula, because Becky was, you know, resting and exhausted the whole time.
I mean, I was there, obviously, a lot of it and holding her hand and everything. But, I couldn't do any of a lot of, like, physical helping. And I also needed to take breaks and things. So, I was, 37 weeks pregnant.
What was going through your brain, Becky? Like, you're like, oh, my God, I'm going to have to do this in a couple weeks.
Definitely some of that. It was definitely a little weird to be, watching the whole process when that was going to be sort of imminent for me, definitely a little bit past the point of return, right? At 4 weeks, or I forget what it was, but something like that,
You were seeing it up close and personal.
I think I was pretty tired. So I was,
I think that was the main
but it was honestly pretty hard to take a nap while you were screaming.
I was not very thoughtful of Becky at that time when I was, doing my thing.
Rightly so. So baby one comes.
Yeah. And then we have our sort of one baby honeymoon at home. And the other big thing that we did not see coming. So our dog joined the family, sort of halfway through. We had done all this. There's a online class we did called Dog Meets Baby. And we had done all this preparation. We want to make sure the dog is good with the babies. So the dog couldn't care less about the babies. The dog completely ignored the babies. The dog hated our doulas.
I think she did start to care about the babies, but it was more of a protective thing.
Yeah.
That was then get the heck away from my babies.
So we spent most of the 6 weeks in between the two births trying to do dog training with a newborn and an 8-month pregnant woman.
I just love the dog trainer who was very nice, but who's like, okay, now one of you, can you get down? And we're like, who?
No one can get down on the ground right now, but there is no ground. No.
Nope. Put the baby down if you would like us to put it down.
That was honestly a lot of time and mind space when we had a newborn at home. Other than that, it was, it's a newborn. Just as we hit our stride.
I feel like it was actually the week before I went into labor, gave birth, was induced. We had actually started going out a little bit.
Yeah.
In terms of with the stroller.
Yeah. We had made it to the park once.
We had left the house.
Yeah. So it's dinner time. Becky checks her blood pressure.
I think it was actually that afternoon. I checked it and it was above their threshold. So I called and they were like, okay, wait 4 hours, check it again. If it's still high, then you'll need to come in. And so then around dinner time, I checked again. It was still high, needed to go in. So we're like, okay, good. Should hopefully be back after they check things and everything. Of course, that was not what happened. And they're like, okay, you have preeclampsia. You're going to need to, you're not leaving the hospital. You're having your baby.
So basically I'm home with a baby.
A newborn.
And I haven't eaten dinner. And Becky calls and says, I'm saying.
And it's go time.
It's go time. And so one of the, like, I think probably one of the hardest parts of this entire thing for me was leaving our first baby at home for the birth of the second baby.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had the hormones, I had the thing, this, you know, I had my brand new baby, and I suddenly have to leave baby with Becky's dad, Papa, who did a wonderful job and you know, couldn't have been in better hands. The big problem we had too was like, we had been prioritizing Becky's sleep in the run up to her giving birth, which obviously made sense, but that meant we were not prioritizing my sleep.
Sure.
And so,
oh God.
Yeah. Oh, so, God. So I was the most useless birth partner for Becky. I mean, the thing too is we had gone through our prenatal classes and I was in, I'm about to have a baby mode. Mm-hmm. And I knew also, oh, I should also be really paying attention to the birth partner
to
side
the other
of
side.
Things, the other side of it. But that somehow just never happened. So I think I was a, you know, not terrible, but not great birth partner. But
You were there.
I was there.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was really hard. I think I was not prepared for how hard that was going to be to like leave kiddo for 4 days.
Tidbit here. Like, so the baby that you left at home is the one that you are not actually genetically tied to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think our experience was that the hormones were the thing for the first 2 months-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And after that,
I definitely thought the one I gave birth to was like the absolute cutest, like, you know, way cuter.
He's
than
like, isn't that amazing that our second baby is so much cuter than our first baby? And I'm like, and I was like, there. You're still on some nice drugs, I think.
It's so funny though.
They were isn't both it? Very cute.
They were both very cute.
It just goes to show how little it really does matter, because, you know, sometimes we get really wrapped. I got really wrapped up with wanting this genetic connection, which is why we ended up having two kids, and which is why, you know. And it could just go to show, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't, that baby's going to come out. You're going to love the hell out of it, no matter whose body, no matter where it came from, you know?
I think that, yeah, the hormones were like very strong and very temporary.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the genetic tie is like occasionally cool and interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. We still like comment upon it sometimes.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, yes. It's like, look, but, you know. But it's like, They're your kids.
Right.
And you know, love is a verb and you love them. And that is ultimately exactly. what matters.
And honestly, sometimes we forget.
To think about it. Which like, yeah, which one did I? Oh, and then this. Yeah.
Actually, I don't think I forget, because I just like to blame when one of them is a jerk. I just like to just be like, that's from you.
Yeah, depending on whether it's a good or a bad trait, I'll say it's an epigenetic or genetic issue.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I'll be like, he learned that by watching you, Anne.
Yeah, your uterus switched off those genes.
Yeah, right.
So funny. So Becky's turn and we do it and it happens.
It went well. It was a similar, like, I had to be induced because of preeclampsia. I had, you know, Anna had gone in sort of saying she, you know, pretty much didn't want to do an epidural. I had said to myself, well, okay, I'll start, you know, I don't think I want one. But I knew, and I had already said this, that like, okay, if you are not sure if you want an epidural, you're probably going to get an epidural, which is exactly what happened, because things kind of, you know, ramped up. And then I was like, yeah, no. Yeah, no.
Yeah.
And Anna, you know, being a good birth partner, you know, knew when to just take me seriously, you know, because I knew, you know, there was a point in her birth where she was expressing potentially wanting an epidural.
Yeah.
And I knew that I should, you know, push back a little bit and try to pause things and all of that, which I did. But she knew that when I said it, it's like, no.
No, she needs it.
Time. I remember. I was like, why did I even
come
think?
Running.
Why did I even think?
So we were at a teaching hospital. Overall positive experience, but there were some funny things. And one of the things is you're dealing with residents. My sort of motto of our birth is I had the amazing nurses and the not so amazing doctors. And Becky had the amazing doctors and the fine nurses. And the anesthesiologist resident who came in to talk to me, because they always come and talk to you regardless, because you might always need it.
Right. Just in case.
Just in case.
To get your sign off.
You know, I was like, oh, yeah, well, I've got a birth plan. I'm, you know, hoping to avoid the epidural. And he actually said, that's what they all say.
Oh, thanks, asshole. That makes me want to keep away from it even more.
That's exactly it. Yeah, and, you know, and of course, now I'm thinking about it. I mean, he doesn't know. He doesn't know. Why would he know that I got through it? But anyway.
Right.
But Becky had.
I'm sure he follows up on all of that.
Right. But yeah, I was like, exactly. I was glad, you know, that Becky had a lovely anesthesiology resident.
That's good. Because when you make the decision that you're going to take it, like, because I wasn't sure. I knew I wasn't going to take it. And then when I changed my mind, it was like, nope, now.
Yeah.
Where is that person now, right. please? No, I don't want another one to come before that thing is in my back.
Right. No, I remember because they probably do this at most hospitals, but before they give you any drugs, they scan your, wrist thing. At least that's what they did there. And so I just remember someone walks in and I'm just like, I just stick my arm out.
Let's go.
I'm ready.
Let's go. It's coming.
Go. So, and then after that, it was just so relaxing. I slept for an hour.
It was delightful.
While I was giving birth, we held hands.
Yeah, Becky basically
gazed into each other's eyes. It was
very calm and peaceful. I kind of get why people do that.
My wife's was, she got the epidural and then it was smooth sailing from then on. And we had a music playlist while she was pushing and it was chill. She was cracking jokes in between the push. Mine was a very crazy experience. It was a whole other story, but it does make a big difference in the calm department.
Yeah.
Yes, it does. And then I think the big problem then was exhaustion. I was just not we got to the postpartum room and I was not in a good place. And I went to sleep for 5 hours because I couldn't, and that's
I was going to ask you for help and you're basically I'm not always going to be able to help you.
It was a low point. It was definitely a low point.
And it begins.
I am the one who pushes through. I am the one who.
Of the two of us, yeah.
I push through. I'm the one. So this was my one moment where I was,
and this was
completely broken.
And this was the moment where I had literally just given birth. I'm trying to deal with a screaming baby that I can't figure out what to do.
He was a screamer. He was a screamer.
He was screaming.
He was not pleased for the first couple of weeks.
For the first while. I just remember sticking him in the bassinet that they put, next to the bed, and he's lying there screaming, and I'm just like, I'm gonna. Just
and actually, this is a thing I actually do have a big issue with, and it is somewhat related to hospital classes. It is somewhat related to the push for breastfeeding, and it is that. Uh-huh. Back in the day, it wasn't a choice. They just took the baby to the nursery and I obviously want to be with the baby in the hospital. But there needs to be a very easy way for you to say, I am too tired to do this right now.
Oh, I know.
And that
I'm guessing
is,
if we had said that,
yeah,
right? The
magic words.
I tried. Because this was my first pregnancy, but it was my second kid. I was tired. I mean, my kid was four, but still I'm a tired mom, and I had to have an emergency C-section. So I was in a lot of pain. I couldn't reach over. I asked them, I said, please, can you take him to the nursery? I need to sleep, please. No, they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't allow me to. And they shamed me for it.
Oh, my God.
And then after that, they barely even helped me. When you have a C-section, you can't reach over and pick the baby up. They didn't help me.
I've heard that the magic words to say are, I am so tired, I'm unable to safely care for my baby. And if they refuse, ask them to document in your chart that they are refusing to provide that.
I would be so scared to say that, though, because I don't want them to take my baby.
Of course.
Yeah. And already I felt so judged.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be it's my second kid. You don't understand. I'm tired.
Right.
I was a mess.
Yeah.
I texted my wife because my wife couldn't stay that night. So basically same situation because she had to go home to our kid. So the first night in the hospital, I had a C-section. Couldn't do anything. And the nurses were terrible to me.
Yeah.
And I was sobbing. I texted her. I said, this is the worst night of my life. And you're not even here. I laid it on her so thick.
Yeah.
So thick. She was like, I'm sorry, babe. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No, but yeah, to your point.
Yeah. And there was not really much we could have done. I mean, and so I slept for 5 hours, woke up, felt a lot better, and we were, good after that.
Did you both breastfeed?
Yes.
And so you were able to help each other out?
So, yes, absolutely,
yes. Right. So, I mean, at the beginning, So our lactation consultant has said, sort of our understanding was that for, the very beginning, it makes the most sense to only breastfeed the baby you gave birth to.
Right.
Because, the breast milk is different at that point. There's colostrum and everything.
And also establishing the,
Right, establishing that and everything. Although, actually, when I had my baby, we did use some of your milk.
Yeah.
To supplement.
We did. Yeah. We did some supplementing with my milk because we had an experience with our first kiddo where my milk didn't come in for a while. And he actually had issues with blood sugar, which led to a one night stay in the intensive care nursery, scared for sort of complicated other reasons that he was fine. Everything was fine, but they needed to monitor some stuff. So we were like, next time we're like, okay, if he needs milk, we're going to give him more milk. Yeah. We have milk. Yeah. We're going to give him more milk. Yeah. I wish I had been faster to supplement with formula too. That's the other thing that I really wish I had been faster to do.
That's what we learned after our first one. And so we were like ready to supplement if we had to. And we ended up eventually, we did have to in the end for both.
And then as it turns out, I did not have quite enough milk. Becky had a ton. So it worked out really well. And we ended up doing a lot of pumping because we had our postpartum doulas there, especially the first couple of weeks after the birth. And so that, you know,
we prioritized sleeping. Yeah. We did not nurse the babies, at night when the doulas
that's
had
amazing.
Them.
Yeah.
So we did. God, yeah.
So nice. We still had to wake up to pump.
We still had to wake up to pump. Yeah. So we both did a lot of pumping. Our house was just like basically a milk factory for a very long time. And then we did a lot of bottle feeding and then still some breastfeeding. And then a few weeks into this, we realized we should switch babies on the breast.
Oh, because the latch would work better.
It was that one of them, you know, I had a lot, and the one that I was nursing was overwhelmed by that and would just like scream stop the fire hose.
And then the other baby was hungry because I didn't have enough. So we ended up primarily breastfeeding the genetic baby. Yeah. Not the one we gave birth to after the first couple of weeks.
For a while.
Honestly, we were breastfeeding directly maybe a third to a half the time and bottle feeding a lot of the time too. Yeah. So it was sort of a big, huge mix.
And then I feel like later, I can't remember when exactly, when they were older, when they were like big enough to like figure stuff up on their own, you know, cause like, we could breastfeed both of them at the same time, which was fun. Yeah. Like so one of us could breastfeed both of them at the same time. Yeah. Cause they could like, you know, it was just so nice cause you could just like lie down and they'd just like crawl on over and okay.
You know. I used to do, when they got down to one night feed at per night, I used to do tandem breastfeeding and it was the most exhausting thing. Cause I would go out there, I'd pick one up, that one would stop crying, I'd put them down, they would start crying, I'd go get the second one, pick them up, that one would stop crying, I'd put them, and I had to do this like whole entire juggling act to get them both on the boob, and then, but then it was great, then I could put them right back to sleep, and it finally was great. So we did just a whole mix of most of pumping, and then a little bit of formula, mostly before Becky's milk came on, because then Becky had enough for us. And then after 6 months, we started doing more formula.
Nice to have all the options, though, right?
I think the big disappointment is you do not get any more sleep with two of you breastfeeding because you still have to pump every three hours.
Before we had really started this process, I do like one of my thoughts was like, oh, if we're giving birth at the same time, we can like take turns. Like you take this night and I'll take the next night. It does not work that way.
Yeah, you have to keep pumping.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Or you're in pain.
Pumping. You're in pain or your supply dwindles or,
it's hard to have a uterus. It is hard work.
So we did our second parent adoptions a few months after the kids were born, basically as soon as we got their birth certificates. And we thought we were, it took a few months. We got our paperwork. And California has awesome step-parent adoptions. Yeah. So it's super easy,
Right. And we each adopted the child that we didn't give birth to.
Right.
Right. But that you are genetically connected to, which is tricky, right? Uh-huh.
And so we thought we were like, great, we've done, check, all set. Mm-hmm. And in the sort of post-election climate, we were people were sort of checking in. We were like checking with our, queer parent networks and be like, hey, does everyone have their, step-parent, second-parent adoption done? And a few people were like, oh yeah, we also did reciprocal IVF and we did double second-parent adoptions in both directions. And we were like, what are you talking about? What is that?
Oh, God.
And so they said, yeah, our lawyer insisted we adopt both the one we gave birth to and the one we didn't give birth to that our spouse gave birth to, because there is apparently a case where the gestational parent is being treated like a surrogate and therefore as a surrogate doesn't have parental rights. And of course, in other states, they're doing the opposite. So we are now going through the process of a whole other
second parent adoption
to make sure we have it covered in both directions.
Oh my God. That's so scary. It's really ridiculous and scary.
Yeah.
Holy moly. Yeah. But it's good you're doing it. And so this is just a nice, good warning for everybody. Like, check with a lawyer.
And like, different lawyers have different opinions about this. Right. And so we talked to one lawyer who was, you know, like, oh, no, I don't think you need it. And then the lawyer we ended up going with, she's like, I understand why they say that. But like, you know, it's just things can change so quickly. And
yeah.
I think there's so much uncertainty right now that it's just, yeah.
Right. I think that they said it's probably not critical, but a good idea.
Yeah. And that's what I always say. It's better to be buttoned up. It's better to be safe than sorry. So why not? If they let you do it, right? Like, why not? Let's just cover all the bases. So it's like, oh my, like I feel like every day it's a new thing that I'm like, oh, that's something I never thought of. You know what I mean? And
right. Our lists are so long of all the things that we have to keep track of keep our kids. Yeah. It's
so scary.
Obscene. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you're doing it. And thanks for letting us know that, because I think it's really important. That is amazing. And how's it going now?
Yeah. So now they're two and a bit. And it's, yeah, so it's
I feel like great. It's honestly gotten more and more fun.
It's gotten more and more fun. They are best buddies.
Oh, good.
That is so cute.
We just moved to big kid beds, mm-hmm. which has mm-hmm. been a lot with two. But they now, because they were in separate cribs before, now they're in big kids' beds.
They were in separate mini cribs. Now they have big kids. We have twin. These are twin beds. So for that, their size, they're like massive.
It's a lot of bed.
And they sleep in the same bed, snuggled up together.
We gave them two beds. They have two
beds.
That's
so cute.
They each have a bed.
But they immediately opted into snuggling up together and sleeping together. And it is the cutest thing.
Oh, I hope they stay close like that.
I was going to say, that is when it's not nap time, where they wander over to the door wanting to leave and then get exhausted and then sleep on the ground.
That also works. Lots of options. They have lots of options.
So there's, you know, lots of options.
Yeah. No, so it's, I mean, it's been, I mean, I would say like it's, you know, the postpartum time is like, that was very intense. Mm-hmm. We also had both of us home for several months.
Yeah.
With that. Which was really lovely.
Yeah.
And I'm staying home with them full time. Mm-hmm. You know, that's been great. And and now we have, you know, it's like it's twins, but harder is sort of the consensus. And like the twin parents.
I guess the harder part. Yeah. Early on, right?
Where you have like the postpartum. They're not quite at the same developmental stage.
Okay.
We were super lucky to keep them on the same sleep schedule.
Yeah.
Which is a big like thing if it's like further apart, that can be really hard to do.
Yeah,
so
totally.
That was a big thing for us, was we managed to keep them on the same
Well, and that
schedule.
Honestly hadn't been part of, at least for me, that wasn't part of my calculation as to why we would want to have them close together. Like, I hadn't thought through or really known that if they had been like 6 months apart, they could end up on diametrically opposed sleep schedules, right? Where like, if they're on two naps and three naps, they just have interleaved sleep schedules where someone is awake at all times.
Yeah, that's exhausting.
I mean, we had never had kids and hadn't, you know, like there's a lot to think through. So hadn't even realized that. But thankfully, you know, they were close enough that we could just, keep them on the same sleep schedule basically the whole time.
Now we have two 2-year-olds and they're talking and running around and climbing and doing all the incredibly fun 2-year-old stuff.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah. And it's just going to get wilder from here. Here we go. Well, it's really awesome. It's amazing. And I'm so glad you came to tell this story. Two pregnancies at the exact same times. Who'd have thunk? Once again, just goes to show that the queers are better and do it way better. Everything. All things better.
I think for me, the big sort of takeaways for me is obviously, you know, there needs to be so much planning on the postpartum, which everyone should be doing anyway.
Right.
You know, everyone should be doing that anyway. And then there's a really great episode with the Pregnant Together folks talking about their postpartum plan. Like, that was like, yes, that's what I should have done. That was.
I know. Wasn't that crazy? I still can't imagine actually going as hardcore as they did. Like, I'm not sure I would allow myself to.
You could actually enjoy having a newborn. That's possible. Like, set yourself
so
up with
eye
that.
Opening,
set yourself
right?
up with that. I think the other big thing for me was postpartum medical care. That's a thing that is absolutely terrible in our system. And a home birth was never on the cards just with our age and medical issue, you know, age and stuff like that. But I didn't realize that I could just hire a midwife for postpartum care.
Yeah.
I think I would have prioritized a midwife-led hospital birth if I could do it over. And failing that, or even in addition to that, midwife postpartum care because the postpartum care, especially if you're doing the thing we did and you have to, right. like, you know, postpartum care, and it's so important. And, you know, I am still dealing with postpartum issues because I didn't really, you know, have the capacity at that time. So
I am still dealing with postpartum issues, I think. And he's 7 years old. Like, yeah, if you don't deal with them, they stay with you.
Yeah. And I had an appalling 6-week postpartum visit. It was terrible. And still paying for that.
Yeah.
And it's like, I should have had a midwife come to my house the day after the baby was born and take care of me there. That's a thing that we should have done and could have done and didn't know about.
So many things that you can do and you don't know. Exactly.
Well, and we had them so close together. So, you know, we didn't really have time to reflect before.
You couldn't do the lesbian overthinking because you were just too tired.
Too tired for any thinking. Yeah.
So that's how we get through the introspection, the lesbian introspection. Just have two babies at once and then you won't do that for a while.
Exactly. Yeah.
This has been really awesome. Thank you so much for telling your story.
Oh, well, our pleasure. And thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. I didn't even tell the listeners that y'all came to me through my mom.
Yeah,
which is amazing.
I somehow didn't even know about the show until a friend of mine who is your mom's neighbor mentioned it to me. And I was like, oh, okay, I need to listen to that. I have been so binging funny. Ever since. I think I'm about 3 years back now in the archives, just loving it. So
funny. Because my mom has been saying, you know, so-and-so has these friends. They're lesbians and they both were pregnant at the same time. You know, she's been telling me, you should have them on. She has been talking about you for a while. So when you finally reached out, I was like, oh my God, I haven't told my mom yet that this was I have to tell my mom. Okay, so funny. So funny. Mama Sue for the win.
Well, thank you, Mama Sue.
Yeah. Thank you, Mama Sue. And thank you. Thanks for coming on. This has been awesome.
Our pleasure.
Queer Family Podcast.
A huge, huge thank you once again to California Cryobank for sponsoring this here little show for an entire year of episodes. Go to cryobank.com, use code LOVEISLOVE, and get a free level 2 subscription to their donor catalog. Go do it. Let's make those babies and uplift these queer families, y'all. Thank you.
Love is love.
Whew. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that episode as much as I enjoyed it. And if you did enjoy it, feel free to listen to another or watch another. I have so many episodes for your listening or viewing pleasure. Just go pick one and enjoy. There's a lot. There really is. And also, if you really do like this show, please, I know I say it all the time, but please do consider supporting the show on Patreon. You're just going to go to patreon.com/thequeerfamilypodcast. You're going to pick a tier, you're going to join, and you're going to get that bonus content. And you're also going to get my love and adoration for the rest of my life. I love you all. Thanks for tuning in. Keep on tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Mwah.